This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Tehran condemns the U.S. sanctions on the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting officials and reporters, saying that this is another example of blatant violation of Iranians' rights by Washington. Officials say more than 80 newborn babies are losing their lives each day in Yemen amid continued Saudi blockade on the war-ravaged country. And Moscow accuses Kiev of committing war crimes by executing more than 10 Russian soldiers after they surrendered. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has condemned U.S. sanctions on the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting officials and reporters. Nasser Kanani said that this is another example of blatant violation of Iranians' rights by the U.S. Kanani said the U.S. is preventing the views of the Iranian people from being heard. He says this while it allows various terrorist networks and media to commit malicious acts against Iran. According to the Iranian official, this shows the U.S. has no plans to end its crimes against independent nations. U.S. sanctions target ahead of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting, as well as a deputy for world services, which also doubles as press TV chief. European Union and Canada have also imposed sanctions on press TV. Bans are part of wider sanctions targeting Iranian officials and entities over alleged human rights violations following recent riots in Iran. Tehran has strongly rejected those claims and slammed the bans as a clear example of meddling in the country's affairs. Author and journalist Arnold August says the U.S. is in no position to lecture Iran on human rights.
Iran TV, I think, is succeeding in carving a place for itself in the international media to give a voice to people not only in Iran but elsewhere in the world who want to tell the truth what is happening in Iran and the international situation, especially the unjust sanctions and the ongoing attempt by the United States and its allies such as Canada for regime change in Iran. How the United States gives itself the right to interfere in any country of the world that refuses to bow down to the U.S. dictates. The latest victim is Iran, not the first time. And imagine the United States, who is known worldwide as a country that suppresses freedom of speech. We have the example of Julian Assange. There are hundreds of political prisoners in the United States because of their ideas. And the United States is going to lecture Iran about freedom of speech. Is there a country in the world that has violated more human rights in so many places in the world than the United States of America, including in its own country, having established the United States based on the genocide of the native peoples in the United States, as well as carrying an ongoing war against the black people in the United States and upholding slavery now in a disguised form, and they are giving lessons to Iran about human rights? Come on now. How many countries have the United States invaded, killed, displaced people? Iraq, Afghanistan, oh, we'd not forget Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Vietnam. There are so many examples. This country has a right, the United States has a right to lecture Iran and anything, especially on violation of human rights.
From Tehran to Tirana is a documentary that will premiere next week on Press TV. Film aims to reveal the truth about the Mojahedin-e-Khalq organization, commonly referred to as the MKO or the MEK, stationed in Manez, Albania, a cult that's carried out numerous terror attacks in Iran, claimed the lives of over 17,000 Iranian politicians, officials, and civilians. Gisu Misha Ahmadi has your details.
The trailer released on Thursday for the documentary movie From Tehran to Tirana is so powerful in its message about the MKO and its practices that it leaves no room for doubting why every defector that has managed to flee insists on calling it a cult where members are required to demonstrate complete devotion to its leader.
Ever since I joined the MKO in Iraq and I realized that they had lied about everything, I wanted to leave, but it was almost impossible. Finally, when we were relocated to Albania, I found the opportunity to escape. Many inside the camp are not as lucky as me.
The movie is inspired by a book of the same name written by a defector who managed to escape the camp 2 decades ago and who has dedicated his life to raising public awareness about the MKO.
Najat NGO was founded by a number of defectors about 15 years ago. Our mission is to reunite families with their loved ones and help defectors escape. We also try to raise awareness about this cult and how they recruit people.
Leaving the camp is almost impossible. I was recruited when I was a prisoner of war in Iraq. I was told that they would help me go home. I later found out that Saddam had allowed this. And also I met members who had come to Camp Ashraf with false promises of employment or asylum in Western countries and brought into Iraq illegally. We were all asked to submit our passports and ID cards, which effectively trapped us there.
The movie also highlights the new methods of recruitment through social media platforms by the MKO's so-called keyboard warriors, a group of about 300 MKO members who run fake social media accounts.
Parents should be very careful. They are now using new methods to recruit the younger generation. They ask these young people to go out on the streets and take part in riots and send them pictures and videos.
This is not the first time the MKO is using social media to advance its agenda. Previous reports by other TV channels has also revealed their strategy.
Should comment by the different account and not MKO members, Mujahideen, because we want to show the Iranian people support Maryam Rajavi.
So you were a troll?
Yes.
You were an internet troll?
Yes.
The Mujahideen Khalq organization, or the MKO, is a known terrorist organization. It has killed more than 17,000 Iranians over the past 43 years, and now it is actively involved in riots in Iran by instigating the younger generation through social media to carry out acts of vandalism. The best way to counter this terrorist organization is to raise public awareness, and this is the main focus of the movie. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Saudi-led war continues to take a heavy humanitarian toll on Yemen, with the country's health ministry saying that more than 80 newborn babies are losing their lives each day. The ministry said nearly 40% of Yemeni babies are born prematurely, marking a drastic increase compared to the pre-war era. Yemeni media said lack of medical supplies and the use of internationally banned weapons by the Saudi-led coalition are major reasons for the premature births. Riyadh, along with some of its allies, launched a devastating war on Yemen, coupled with a blockade back in March of 2015, with the aim of reinstating a friendly regime in the country. Yemen is currently suffering from what the UN has time and again described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Earlier this week, a Yemeni health official blamed the Saudi war and siege for the spread of disease and infection, including malaria. Earlier, we were joined by human rights activist Firas Al-Najim from Canada to get his thoughts about the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Yemen. Here he is.
Yes, this is obviously a very dangerous situation, and it's been dangerous since the day they started the war and imposed this blockade against the people of Yemen. And unfortunately, it's backed up and supported by the Western regimes, including Canada. Not that they only back it up, I mean, by supporting it, in the United Nations and staying silent on this issue. And at the same time, they also help and give, logistical support to the Saudi coalition. At the same time, they help them with their media as well, how to paint the picture as if they're coming there to support the Yemeni people or support some type of Yemeni democratic system. Same time, Canada is supplying arms to Saudi Arabia instead of supplying medical supplies to the people of Yemen. You know, this is where we see something that is very controversial, and that shows a picture that these regimes are not truly working for human rights, and they're not truly working to help the people and stop these humanitarian crises. They're actually fueling these humanitarian crises. They're actually making them larger than they already are. And if they care so much about human rights, and if they care so much about humanity in general, you know, Canada, the U.S., France, Britain, all these governments, you know, they would impose sanctions against Saudi Arabia. They would, have a no-fly zone in certain areas in Yemen, and they would stop this war. They would send in the UNIFIL forces or any other forces that they could, to stop this war fully. But they're not doing that. They're actually watching the people of Yemen die day by day, and the suffering getting worse and worse.
And now Russia has accused Ukraine of war crimes over what Moscow calls the execution of several soldiers that after they surrendered. Russian Defense Ministry says that no one can paint a murder of over 10 restrained Russian soldiers as a tragic exception. This comes after footage circulating on social media allegedly shows a summary execution of Russian servicemen. The Defense Ministry says videos are new evidence on the massacre of unarmed Russian prisoners of war. It says the Western backers of Ukraine are turning a blind eye to its military abuses. Meanwhile, Russia's Human Rights Council says it will ask for an international probe. Earlier this week, a UN report accused both Russia and Ukraine of abusing and torturing prisoners of war. The U.S. is bracing for more drawn-out legal battles involving Donald Trump, with the Justice Department naming a special counsel to investigate the former president. The U.S. Attorney General says appointment of Jack Smith is in the public interest because Trump has announced his intention to run for president again in 2024. Probe will look into Trump's handling of sensitive documents, as well as his involvement in the 2021 Capitol riot by supporters. Trump has dismissed appointment of the special counsel as political and unfair. He's already been investigated by a special counsel over obstruction of justice and possible election collusion with Russia, but no charges were brought against him. The former president was also impeached twice, but acquitted on both occasions. Meanwhile, the UK government has unveiled an emergency budget. It includes tens of billions of dollars in spending cuts and tax increases as the government seeks to restore its economic credibility and patch up the nation's battered finances. Saeed Puruza reports out of London.
Transfixed, ordinary Britons stand glued to their screens, waiting for the news to sink in. After weeks of will he not, the UK's new chancellor has announced his economic plan for the country. Except for a couple of surprise rabbits out of the hat, such as a bit of more spending in the health and education sectors, it was what everyone had expected. Tax hikes and spending cuts aimed at plugging a nearly $65 billion hole in public finances created by the previous Conservative government only 2 months ago. Pretty soon, millions of Britons will be paying more taxes. A freeze on the non-taxable part of their income will mean millions will be dragged into higher tax brackets, and the cap on energy bills introduced by the previous government will be scaled back as of April next year. As if that wasn't enough, Britons are going to see public sector spending cuts to the tune of $30 billion. All this as the country grapples with double-digit inflation, rising energy costs, and a prolonged recession, none of which was lost on the opposition.
What does this mean? Family holidays cancelled, savings depleted, hopes for the future replaced by sleepless nights. And all of this on top of the fact that the average worker is earning less today than when the Tories came to power 12 years ago. The government has presided over the biggest wage squeeze in centuries. This was a crisis made in Downing Street, and it is ordinary working people who are paying the price.
As ever, the Chancellor, as did the PM before him, blamed Britain's economic woes on the pandemic and external factors such as the war in Ukraine. But many experts say that's not all.
There are international factors. However, Britain has managed to achieve something on its own for one or two areas, such as the impact of Brexit. Whereas when they were in the EU, they had access to the world's largest free trade area, Britain deliberately took itself out of that and hasn't been able to replace it with anything. So that's had extra cost to it. And so there's also been less confidence in Britain because it's outside that. Why should I be investing? And so if it's not seen to be as really secure and full of confidence, then investors will go elsewhere. And that's what we've been seeing.
Despite the government saying its measures announced today are necessary for balancing the books, there is no doubt that they will have real consequences for millions of Britons for years to come. Saipur is up, London.
And now, to revive the Persian language, an Indian-administered Kashmir exhibition is showcasing dozens of Persian manuscripts and books written by a prominent poet. Exhibition opened Monday, running for a week. Manowar Zaman has your details.
In Shah-e-Darab, a week-long exhibition in Indian-administered Kashmir is displaying dozens of rare manuscripts written by prominent poet Khwaja Muhammad Amin Darab. The language was once officially used in courts and commerce until 1889. The organizers say the aim of the event is to revive Persian language in the region. About 73 manuscripts, including a dozen books written by Darab, are on display.
Persian is so deeply entrenched that you can't think of our craft without Persian. You can't think of Kashmiri language, forget about Persian, without Persian language. You can't think of our basic ethical and sacred knowledge without Persian.
Persian is what Kashmir is all about. And it still has a resonance in contemporary Kashmiri society. If you go to any urs on any major shrine of Kashmir, the manqabat and the naats that are recited will be jami. They will be in Persian.
Chronogram on Neil Armstrong's landing on the moon, Maharaja of Kashmir's accession to the throne in 1923, elegies of prominent scholars, including on the death of Muslim scholar and jurist Maulana Anwar Shah Kashmiri, are being displayed in the exhibition. The Arab was instrumental in transmitting traditional Persian literature in the region. He is also known as a master of Kitah Tariq and Naats in the praise of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Darab died in 1979 in Srinagar, but his memories and writings continue to enlighten hearts and minds in the region. The remnants of Persian verses are widely recited in mosques, shrines, Sufi and spiritual gatherings. The Persian language reached its peak in Kashmir during the Mughal rule, but faded with the course of time. The exhibition organizers say events like this are an ideal platform to revive Persian language and literature.
I want people to know what he has written, because if you keep it in boxes, nobody would know. Maybe the language is not here anymore, but the language never dies. See, even now some people are so interested in it, that's why we are getting a good response. And there is so much of culture in this language, there is so much of history about Kashmir as well in the language, because it's somehow connected with Iran.
Organizers say Darab's contribution to Persian literature in the valley is also highlighted in documentation of the greatest poets, Ghani Kashmiri. Munawar Zaman, Indian-administered Kashmir.
And that's a wrap for your latest. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The racist behavior of the anti-Islamic groups in Germany has angered the Muslim community in that country. Far-right groups in Germany are trying to exploit the current economic and energy crises to instill fear and hatred against minorities, in particular Muslims. But despite the spread of Islamophobia in the West and the rise of far-right groups in the last two decades, conversion to Islam among Europeans has actually increased significantly. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered the same story. German authorities registered at least 662 Islamophobic crimes in 2021. There were more than 46 mosques attacked in Germany, and at least 17 people were injured because of anti-Muslim violence. Süleyman Demir, project director at the anti-discrimination group INSAN, said attacks on Muslims and mosques have seen a rise following the coronavirus pandemic, and the situation is serious as Germany is facing economic difficulties. Süleyman Demir added, the statistics have definitely increased, especially for women who wear the headscarf. He said, we're also increasingly seeing from our community that not only men but also women who wear the hijab are exposed to much more physical attacks, and this has actually increased significantly in recent years. German authorities recorded 152 Islamophobic attacks, while at least 7 people were injured in the first 6 months of 2022. But that might not be the full picture, because many of the attacks go unreported. Süleyman Demir, who is leading the Network Against Discrimination and Islamophobia project at INSAN, said many Muslims do not report incidents to the German police, thinking their complaints will not be taken seriously. Demir added, sometimes they don't feel heard or seen, and that's why they think, oh, why report it anyway? There won't be any consequences. He urged better sensitivity training for police officers to tackle Islamophobic crimes. Demir said, police officers are not properly trained. They're not trained on tackling anti-Muslim crimes, adding that many incidents of Islamophobia are not properly registered by police in crime statistics. Süleyman Demir also warned that far-right groups are trying to exploit the ongoing economic and energy crisis in Germany to stir fear and hatred against minorities, and in particular Muslims. He said, it is easy to portray minorities as scapegoats, that is, as scapegoats for political or economic problems in the country. And the far-right groups naturally use this method to say that these minorities are to be blamed for the major economic crisis in the country. Therefore, I see a connection between the rising right-wing extremism and the economic situation in the country. Demir said it is important for Muslims and minorities to be more politically active to strengthen democracy and counter the rise of the far-right. He said, there are people from 180 to 200 different nations here, so I assume that Muslims will also feel at home here, especially those who were born here. They will take part in democratic decision-making and, of course, will also shape the future of Germany. Meanwhile, the Shia Studies website has also reported on the same story. A survey conducted by researchers from Germany, Netherlands and Britain revealed veiled Muslim women face far more discrimination than others when applying for jobs in these countries. Utrecht University in the Netherlands, Oxford University in England and the German Centre for Integration and Migration Research conducted a joint field survey on the discrimination faced by religious minorities seeking jobs in the three European labour markets, that is, Germany, Netherlands and Spain. The findings of the experiment were shared in an article published by Oxford Academic recently titled Discrimination Unveiled, a field experiment on the barriers faced by Muslim women in Germany, the Netherlands and Spain. The experiment was conducted with the curriculum vitae of the same people by using the same content and information with both veiled and unveiled photographs. As the photographs on curriculum vitae shows whether the person wears a hijab or not, the cross-nationally harmonized experiment aimed to demonstrate to what extent the responses of these people received from employers differ. The results in the Netherlands proved that 35% of women with headscarves got responses from employers, while this rate rose to 70% among those not wearing headscarves. The experiment said a similar scenario in Germany, showing that 25% of the veiled candidates and 53% of the unveiled candidates received responses from employers. The article stressed, Muslims are perceived by the public at large as a difficult-to-integrate group, mainly due to their high levels of religiosity, which are seemingly at odds with the so-called European values and the secular lifestyles of Western societies. It presented robust evidence that veiled Muslim women are discriminated against in Germany and in the Netherlands, for example, when applying for jobs that require a high level of customer contact. In Germany, even though employers responded to the job application of half of the unveiled Muslim women, they did not give any response to 75% of the Muslim women wearing headscarves. The website of the Middle East Monitor has also covered the same story. A new report has warned Islamophobia remains a growing threat across Europe, with several countries enacting policies that have contributed to the institutionalization of an issue that should instead be stamped out with urgency. According to the European Islamophobia Report 2021, Islamophobia was as pressing a problem across the European continent as it was in previous years. It said countries like Germany, France and Britain became the main spots of anti-Muslim hatred and Islamophobic incidents. The report, which focused on the 27 European countries and was prepared with contributions from 35 leading academics and experts in the field, read, "Furthermore, anti-Muslim campaigns of far-right political parties in the European Union member states dominate the discrimination against Muslim individuals and communities." The report links the persistence of anti-Muslim racism to the backdrop of general worrisome trend, the decline of liberal democracy in Europe. It warns that major forces within Europe, singling out countries like Germany, are still investing less in the fight against Islamophobia and more into normalizing Islamophobia. The report said, "The Islamophobia becoming normalized and institutionalized by the so-called liberal democracies such as Germany and France is alarming." Apart from Islamophobic incidents across Europe, the report details systemic discrimination faced by Muslims in all areas of life, from employment to healthcare to education and to the justice system. Germany has the second largest Muslim community in Western Europe, after France, with total inhabitants of more than 84 million. Among the country's nearly 5.5 million Muslims, 3 million are of Turkish origin.
Oh. This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Back to Reality. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Asma, your host, here with. I have two very dear guests, Sister Bita and Brother Abu Zahra.
Assalamu
alaikum wa rahmatullah. Both of you, welcome to your program. And it's a pleasure to have you in here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
nice
for coming.
Assalamu alaikum. It's nice to be here again. I'm a Hausa student right at the moment. I'm in my, I think, in my ninth year. And before this, I was in life sciences. So I've got a taster of quite a few things, alhamdulillah.
Yeah.
Assalamu alaikum, and I'm really honored to be here at this episode. My name is Bita, and I'm a medical student. And
we're happy to have you both.
Thank you.
Many people go to other countries in order to pursue their life and their goals and dreams. Sometimes it is a tough thing to get accustomed to a new environment, which is actually most importantly, not having the same religion as yours. So as a Muslim woman, as a Muslim man, when I go to another country, specifically if I have kids, then the situation is going to be very hard. Now, what do you think?
First of all, I want to tell you that when you accept a religion, a religion is a whole thing, and you have to accept all of the details in that whole, in that Sharia, you know? And for example, you cannot choose something in this Sharia and tell me that, okay, I'm going to go through another country, that women are not Muslim, so I'm not going to make hijab. No, it's not like that.
Exactly.
When you accept this religion, you have to accept all of the details in this religion. Even in this religion, we have two different categories of responsibilities and actually activities, personal and social.
Exactly.
I think when you go through another country which is non-Muslim or something, doing the activity which are personal is somehow easier.
Exactly.
But it's not impossible to actually do your responsibility in activities which are social.
It's not impossible, but it's still difficult.
Yeah, it's more difficult.
Yeah, so alhamdulillah, I have lived in non-Muslim countries most of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely possible to be a Muslim, a good Muslim. When I say Muslim, I mean practicing Muslim.
Yeah.
It's definitely difficult, seeing that human beings naturally are influenced by people who are around them. It's definitely a challenge. There's two things as well to consider. One is that being practicing Muslim in our actions, and the other one is our ideology and our belief system. Now, what I've noticed a lot, especially what happens in Western countries, so the America and North America and Europe, is that you find a lot of Muslims who are practicing Muslims in their actions, but in their thinking, they very much think in a non-Muslim way.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And recently that's become a bit more troubling than actually, you know, not being a practicing Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
See, because when you don't practice Islam, you're not doing the outward action. It's easy to spot that. But when you're influenced by a non-Islamic thinking, it's something that's really hard to pinpoint.
Exactly.
And you don't realize that, right? It's something that you're living thinking you're a Muslim, but in reality, if you look inside yourself and you really try to look at your beliefs through a magnifying glass, you realize that a lot of your beliefs are non-Islamic. And this is where I feel the biggest danger is in living in non-Muslim countries,
yeah,
where your core beliefs, the thing that makes you who you really are as a Muslim, those things are affected.
Pandora's box is opened now. Let's go for a short break, and after that, we'll go for the rest of our topic.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
How do you feel when you go to a non-Muslim country and then you have to practice your rituals, you have to be your true you and be a good Muslim?
Even with the small, small things that, for example, people living in Iran might not even think about it.
Yeah.
So the first time, for example, I came to Iran, it was very awkward to go to the supermarket and just pick up stuff
and
put in your basket and just pay for it.
Yeah.
You know, when you're in the UK, for example, everything you pick up, even if it's something like a biscuit or a cereal,
yeah,
you always
chocolate.
Turn the thing, look at the ingredients,
yeah,
right? Because
yeah,
there's a lot of, for example, animal ingredients that are used even in something as innocent as a cereal or a cake or something like that. Right?
Exactly.
So I remember still going down the aisles and, you know, pick up something like, for example, hot chocolate. I don't know. Just pick it up and just check
even
behind
hot chocolate.
It. You know, small things like this.
That exactly.
When you come to an Islamic country, you don't have that need. And it's really nice. And you really appreciate them living in an Islamic country. You feel freer. You know how they say that Islam restrictions, so on. It's not like that. It's like when you come here, you really feel free.
Exactly.
You know, you feel like you can put your hands down and, you know, live a comfortable life, because now you don't have that constant pressure of being forced, socially forced, to disobey Allah.
Sister,
yeah.
Now as a woman, I would like to ask you, usually for men, it's pretty much easier.
I do agree.
To keep everything just the same as they are and then to travel into another country and mm-hmm. then be who they are. But for women, it's a bit of different, you know. If you are going to go for education, then you are going to enter a university full of people who are just not like you. And then you are going to be distinguished among the crowd.
Yeah.
And it's a hard, sad feeling, I guess.
It is, actually, because in any actually aspect, being different is somehow difficult. Because no matter, you are better or you are, you know, less than them.
Superior or inferior.
Yeah, exactly. It is always difficult to be different. And even I think it's more difficult when it comes to your appearance. When you have something which makes you different from another society, it's like, okay, this feeling of looking down on you is somehow bothering. And I agree with that one. Just make it slight.
You mean you can still have hijab, but not so much distinguished as you have all the eyes on you.
Yeah, exactly. And I had always this question, but I think the answer is you can be yourself wherever you are. And this is freedom, you know. In other countries, especially developed countries, they claim that we actually provide you with freedom. Mm-hmm. You can be whatever you want. And I want to be this, I want to be that. So you have to allow me to be this, first of all, and then you have to accept me.
But
and
actually, we know that it's easier said than done.
Yeah.
I feel outnumbered, but I don't think...
Sorry.
I would disagree with you saying that it's much easier for men than for women.
How come?
Because I think it's true that a Muslim woman has the hijab and in one way she stands out in society, so in a Muslim society. But I feel for men is possibly as hard, because we may not stand out in the sense that when people look at us, but there are certain challenges, because there are certain challenges that we have to go through that women might not need to go through, right? There's a certain amount of acceptability that we have to have in society, especially, for example, if a woman gets married and you know, a lot of her time is spent being a mother, the man has to go in the workplace, he has to go out, he has to interact with people, and he has to be constantly at the face of a society that is not accepting him, right? And that is difficult, right? There's different sins that are out there. There's people you have to interact with on a daily basis at the workplace. And I feel this is quite difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So I think both men and women have their own challenges
society. The war that happens to a man is actually an internal war. And the thing that happens to a woman is more outer. You know what I mean? What happens is that you would be bombarded with too much of eyes on you. And it is going to be pretty much difficult. But the thing that happens to men is actually more of an internal thing. It's an internal challenge.
Even as a Muslim man, people can tell I'm a Muslim, right? Firstly, I'm a foreigner, right?
Yeah.
I'm brown skin. So if you're in Europe, then you already stand out. And then having a beard, for example, that makes you stand out, for example, right? So already people's eyes are on us as much as they are on the women.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't say that I agree that having the hijab is a challenge. Right. But this idea that, you know, it's so much more difficult for women than it is for men. This is the part that I disagree with. I think men have their share of challenges. And in today's world, it's all about, you know, women are suffering.
Yeah.
Hello, men are also suffering.
So in this part, I have to agree with you. Actually, this is challenging for mm-hmm. both, you know, men and women. But actually, despite the fact that it is really hard to be a Muslim person in a non-Muslim country, one thing which is, I think, harder and more difficult and more challenging is bringing up a child.
Yeah.
Which should be a Muslim in a non-Muslim country, you know. And I think this is a challenge that I always was searching the answer for that. For example, you have a child which is going to go through a school which is non-Muslim, and all the other children are eating something which you are not sure about the ingredients of that thing, or even for girls, hijab or something. And
well, now this
issue
is nothing compared to other issues, because now you can go and pick the kind of food for your children yourself. If you say, if
you know, you cannot control other...
I'm talking about other things, you know? So. The other things are more dangerous because then your child is going to go from a society which has been just the same as him or her, but now they're entering a new society in which everything is broader. We had a relative and he used to say that when his son didn't go to school, then they came from the school into the house and they started to go to the room and closed the room and then it started bombarding the kid about what happened. Why didn't you come to your school? Is there anything bothering you? Is there blah, blah? And you know how kids are. You cannot trust whatever they say, but if they say something wrong, then it would be so custy. Am I right?
Yeah, definitely. Because they're growing up at a stage where they don't have a strong free will yet.
Exactly.
So they're going to be exposed to many things and who knows how it's impacting them. Hopefully, inshallah, if we do the tarbiyah properly, then hopefully that child, when they've reached that maturity, would be strong enough to make their own decisions.
Yeah, I wish all the parents luck in upbringing their children. Now let's go for a short break, after which we'll pursue our discussion. Welcome back. This is Back to Reality. We are talking about living in another country in which people are not practicing the same religion as you do.
And when this comes to social matters, it's a whole new ballgame. You know, you can protect yourself in your personal things. And one of the things that the sister mentioned at the start of the program with regards to your involvement in social matters, this is really key, right? You have the choice to live in a non-Muslim country and mind your own business. But again, as your responsibility as a Muslim is that you should get involved in social matters. If there is injustice, then you should stand up against it. You know, if somebody is suffering, you should be helping them. And this is where it gets really challenging. What's too less and what's too much in this, right? So you always get confused, especially when you live in a country that's politically a bit very different to what Islam would have in mind. Should I be doing more? Should I become an activist? You know, and that could even lead to risking your own life, right?
Exactly.
So if you look at Islam in a broader sense, and it's not just about me, but about society as well, then your challenges as a Muslim become manifold, right? It's a lot more that you need to think about. And also you're representing Islam to the people. If people want to know what's a Muslim or what is Islam, and you're the only Muslim in the area, then they're going to be like, okay, let me see what kind of person this person is. And it's not only for the scholars, right? We have our own duty, but every single Muslim living in a non-Muslim country is actually holding the flag of Islam.
There are some Islamic countries that they call themselves Islamic, but actually when you go through them, for example, hijab is not a rule for all the people, or there are some rules which, for example, Muslim people can do and non-Muslim people cannot do, you know?
Yeah.
And there is no necessity or obligation for example, these parts of this religion for them, but they call them Islamic. And that was really bothering for me.
They actually call themselves Islamic, but they do not act accordingly.
Yeah.
You would have expectations from a so-called Islamic country to put certain rules that makes you as a Muslim feel safer and more relaxed to live as a Muslim. And then the next thing you know is everywhere you go, there's a pub, there's a casino. It's like, come on, we're supposed to be at home over here, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely, it's quite sad.
So I guess it's all about security, that we have to search for the things that exist in our religion in order to be practiced in a country, in a society, whatever. But we actually were talking about living in a foreign country that carries the different perspectives about religion, and they do not actually practice the same religion as us. So we said that there must be so much of difficulties as a woman or as a man. The basement is usually the most important thing that matters.
You've made it sound very bleak and dark. There's a lot of people who live there and successfully as good Muslims, alhamdulillah. And whilst it's difficult, it's still very doable. And if we have enough knowledge and we know what we need to take care of, if we know the type of places we shouldn't be going to, we know the type of food we shouldn't be eating and stuff, and we have a conscious mind, then we can live a good life.
Yeah, right? And
we
then
can live
by
a good
time,
life, can be comfortable.
What we were talking about was actually the first days of getting there. Because
yes,
after a certain time, as human beings get accustomed to everything very easily, you will just get used to it.
You'll get used to it. You'll know what to keep an eye out for.
So I guess this is all the time that we had for today's episode. Thank you, dear guests, and thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us.
Thank you.
Until another session, I bid you farewell. May Allah protect you and save you from all the evils. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In Britain, Chancellor Jeremy Hunt is planning to boost the national living wage in an effort to help Britons through the cost of living crisis. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Sun has more for us. Jeremy Hunt is planning to boost the national living wage in an effort to help Britons through the cost of living crisis. The Chancellor of the Exchequer is preparing a 10% hike, which would see the threshold rise from £9.50 to £10.40 an hour. The move would mean a payday for more than 2.5 million Britons. The national living wage is the minimum amount all employers have to pay staff aged 23 and over. Those younger than 23 years old can be paid the minimum wage instead, which is £9.18 an hour for 21 and 22-year-olds and £6.83 an hour for those aged 18 to 20. Final confirmation of changes to the living wage will come this Thursday, when Jeremy Hunt reveals his autumn statement. The major budget will deal with how the Treasury is going to fill an estimated £50 billion black hole in the public purse. The gaping hole came about because of the coronavirus pandemic, the Russia-Ukraine conflict, soaring energy costs, and Liz Truss's disastrous mini-budget. On Sunday, the Chancellor warned tax rises will hit everyone and that we'll all be paying a bit more tax. Gloomy Jeremy Hunt added that There will be no enticing rabbit out of the hat policies either. But yesterday, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak dropped his biggest hint yet that pensioners will be protected while others feel the squeeze. Asked if he would hike pensions in line with inflation next year, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak insisted he was someone who understands the particular challenge of pensioners, adding that they will always be at the forefront of my mind. However, the Chancellor Jeremy Hunt is set to give councils more power to raise local taxes to pay for social care. Currently, local government chiefs are only allowed to hike it by 2.99%, plus a 1% levy for elderly care without a local referendum. But the threshold for such a vote is set to be raised, meaning it is harder to block hikes. Meanwhile, Jeremy Hunt will call time on the £10 billion a month universal energy bill support, with only the least well-off in line for hefty support. Bills for the average British home are set to be capped £500 higher than now at £3,000. Sky News has also covered the same story. Chancellor Jeremy Hunt will announce a rise in the national living wage this week. Jeremy Hunt and Prime Minister Rishi Sunak will accept an official recommendation to increase the living wage from £9.50 an hour to about £10.40 an hour, according to news first reported by The Times. The rise of nearly 10% would benefit around 2.5 million people, according to The Times. Among the other measures reportedly being considered are cost of living payments for 8 million households worth up to £1,100, payments of £650 for those on means-tested benefits such as universal credit, £150 for disability benefit recipients, and £300 for pensioner households. Freezing of thresholds for income tax, national insurance, VAT, inheritance tax, and pension savings. Removing the requirement for local authorities to hold a referendum before increasing council tax by more than 2.99%, allowing them to raise significantly more money. The new threshold could be 5%, according to the Daily Telegraph. The moves are part of plans to cut spending by £33 billion and raise taxes by £22 billion to plug a black hole in Britain's finances. The government has already said the poorest households will be prioritised, leaving wealthy and middle-income households to bear the greatest burden from tax increases. One of the main focuses will be energy cuts, with changes to be made to the price guarantee announced in September by Rishi Sunak's predecessor Liz Truss. The price guarantee meant that a typical household would face energy bills of no more than £2,500 a year, but this could rise to as much as £3,100 from next April, and even this would leave taxpayers with a large bill. There have also been hints that the autumn statement on Thursday could include benefits and pensions being increased in line with inflation, a move that will cost around £11 billion. The triple lock on the state pensions, which guarantees an increase in line with average earnings, inflation or 2.5%, whichever is higher, was part of the Conservatives' manifesto in 2019. But as inflation soared past 10%, it has become increasingly expensive. Speaking to reporters accompanying him on his trip to the G20 summit in Bali, Indonesia, Rishi Sunak said, "My track record as Chancellor shows I care very much about those pensioners, particularly when it comes to things like energy and heating, because they're especially vulnerable to cold weather. That's why when I announced support earlier this year as Chancellor, we made extra provision for pensioners to receive up to £300 alongside their winter fuel payments to help them cope with energy bills over the winter months. So I'm someone who understands the particular challenge of pensioners, they will always be at the forefront of my mind. Website of LBC, lbc.co.uk, has also covered the same story. Pensioners are set to escape brutal spending cuts as Prime Minister Rishi Sunak raises the living wage in a boost for the poorest. Prime Minister Sunak and Chancellor Jeremy Hunt will accept an official recommendation to increase the living wage from £9.50 an hour to around £10.40 an hour, a rise of nearly 10%. 8 million households will also receive cost-of-living payments worth up to £1,100, as Rishi Sunak introduces targeted support for poorest over universal measures. Those on universal credit could receive £650, disability benefit recipients £150, and pensioner households will receive £300, with some people able to claim all three. However, the energy price guarantee is set to increase from a £2,500 bill for the average home to as much as £3,100 from next April. Treasury sources would neither confirm nor deny speculation ahead of Thursday's autumn statement. It comes after Rishi Sunak hinted at keeping the pension's triple lock, which guarantees an increase in line with average earnings, inflation, or 2.5%, whichever is higher, as he spoke during his trip to the G20 summit in Bali, Indonesia. Rishi Sunak said, "My track record as Chancellor shows I care very much about those pensioners, particularly when it comes to things like energy and heating." He declined to comment on any specifics in the financial statement, but stressed that we will put fairness and compassion at the heart of all decisions we make. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak and Chancellor Jeremy Hunt are said to be considering allowing local authorities to impose larger rises in council tax next year to raise money for social care among their tax hiking measures.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.